The following presentation was recorded at a Christian Light Education workshop. More information at clp.org.
All right. This is geometry and thinking skills. So we'll be looking at some things with geometry. Just to get us going here, I'm not sure how well you can see it, but here's an example. Here's a picture. I picked this up at a garage sale. Some pictures like this. A lady wanted to buy a watering pot for her flowers, and she wants the one that holds the most water. Which one would you buy if you want the one that holds the most water? The tall one or the short one? Now, some of you are looking at that, and immediately you know which one you want to buy. Some of you are looking at it, and you're not sure. You know there must be a puzzle somewhere, but you're not sure what it is. You suspect maybe it isn't the tall one, but here's a little puzzle yet. All right. There was an engineering problem. The spout on the tall one isn't long enough. The water will all run out. Now, with spatial thinking, geometry is one of those areas that for some people, some people prefer calculating and working with numbers. Other ones just enjoy working with spatial things. Let me show you, let's look at the outline, at the handout. So geometry is a branch of mathematics that it does include working with numbers, such as positives, negatives, fractions, and so on. But it also includes working with space, points, line segments, angles, rays, rectangles, squares, solid figures, triangles, and so on. The word geometry actually means earth measure, measuring the earth. And it's a very common, it's needed in many, many kinds of occupations, like designing buildings and cabinet making, designing kitchen cabinets, surveying, and so on. And so it involves, in addition to the numerical thinking that we use in arithmetic and also the quantitative thinking, it also includes the spatial or visual thinking. And it starts with, let me just give you a couple more examples of spatial reasoning, spatial thinking. So, for example, here is a cardboard cutout. You could take a piece of cardboard like this and cut it out in this shape and then color the blocks accordingly. And then if you folded them together into a box, which of these four boxes could it possibly be? Now, I'm not going to take the time, in fact, you can't see it that well, but the point is that only one of these four could possibly be made from that because of the relationship of the colors to each other. They tell us here that the correct answer is A, and there's a reason for that. Some of you can probably see that immediately, but if you're like me, you'd have to reason through, well, if this black, the black has to be next to the gray, for example, and then that would go next to and so forth. But that's a kind of spatial reasoning. Another example would be, another fold-out would be something like this, where you have something you fold together into a little barn or a little shed. And then the gable ends, one could be gray, one white, but you start looking down here and say, now which ones of the bottom could not possibly be formed from the top? And well, you can see immediately that some can't, because you can't have a white below a gray, because both of these ends have to be gray. So this is just a few quick examples of this kind of spatial or visual thinking. Now, what I'd like to do in this session is talk about three major areas. The first one is how in the world of geometry, and actually in the world of mathematics, there are many opportunities to notice the power and the wisdom and the majesty of God. He has hidden in the natural world unbelievably great numbers of sequences and spirals and so on. Now, on the first example I have on your handout here is called the Fibonacci sequence. It's found all throughout the natural world. And let me read a bit. If you have it as a teacher, it's nice to have a good resource book or two for yourself beyond the math book you have for your students. If you haven't read this one, it's a good one to get your hands on, called Mathematics, Is God Silent? By James Nichol. I believe he was a Canadian, in fact. I'm not sure, but this is available. It's actually been updated in 2001. Now, he points out that here that the world of mathematics, some people think that mathematics is simply cut and dried. I mean, 2 plus 2 is 4. There's nothing religious about it. There's no religion. There's no faith involved in math at all. It's just what you have is what you get. And he points out that there's a history to mathematical theories and claims, actually, that as you understand the language of math, which is a language that the physical world operates on, it actually does point to a personal, caring God who's involved with his creation. And there are some of the chapters end with review questions, rather significant review questions, such as this one. Explain why a biblical worldview requires a universe and why a humanistic worldview requires a multiverse. Now, what I'd like to... This has a section talking about the Fibonacci sequence. Let me just read a bit. The Fibonacci sequence, on your paper, you'll notice it starts with zero. Now, it's a rather simple sequence, and you wonder, well, what's the big deal about it? Who's familiar with the Fibonacci sequence? Let's just, all right. So, you start with zero, and next to zero comes one. Now, from here on, you add the numbers together, the number right before. Zero plus one is what? Say it. One. One plus one is two. Two plus one is three. Three plus two, five. Five plus three, eight. And so on. It keeps on going without stopping. And on your paper, I have a few more. Now, the two things about this, one is that if you take eight and divide it by five, five into eight, you take any two numbers in the sequence, the higher the numbers are, the more precise is the ratio. But the ratio comes out to about 1.618 on any two numbers on that sequence. Now that ratio of 1 to 6.18 is so common in the world of nature that it has its own little symbol. Okay, reading in here, it says this was first recognized and popularized in the 13th century. And the numbers are so common in creation that in 1963, a magazine called the Fibonacci Quarterly began to be published by something called the Fibonacci Association. And the only purpose of this publication is to document the occurrence of the sequence in nature. In other words, each quarter, they collect together places that mathematicians and scientists have found this sequence in the world of nature and published this. We found it in a dozen more places, or 20 more places. And there's still, you can Google this, they're still finding more and more. Now, these numbers, the Fibonacci numbers, are found in the spiral arrangements of petals, of pine cones, and pineapples. Now, if you look at a pine cone from the top of a pine cone, you notice that there are spirals. If you look, depending how you look at it, there are spirals going one way, and then you can see other spirals going the other way. Now, the interesting thing is that those spirals in a pine cone, there are five spirals the one way and eight spirals the other way. You look on your list, and those are Fibonacci numbers. They are next to each other in the Fibonacci sequence. In a pineapple, spirals, the pair one way and the other in a pineapple, depending which pineapple you look at the end of it, you can go home and get a pineapple and try this. Some pineapples will have 5 one way, 8 the other. Some will have 8 one way and 13 the other. In sunflowers, do you have sunflowers around here? In sunflowers, there's a lot more options. And I think on your handout, I don't have a sunflower on your handout, do I? But I have some here. As you look at a sunflower head, you can kind of see the dots almost dancing at you there. Well, it's possible to count the spirals this way or this way. And here's one example on a sunflower where if they number them all, if you come up with 34 spirals the one way, and then depending on how you count them, you can come up with going at a different angle, you come up with 55. Here, you come up with 21. And what they'll tell you is that no matter how you count the spirals on a sunflower, you will always come up with a Fibonacci number. There is no other. And these will be in pairs. So going on, he says that on a sunflower, the pairs can be 8 or 13. They can be 21 and 34. 34, 55. 55, 89, or 89 and 144. And so there the Fibonacci seek numbers, pairs, are found in the spiral of the sunflower. It's also found in the nail bee. They explain here, you see a little chart showing the genealogy of a bee. It starts out, it says a male bee has only one parent, the female bee. Female bee has two parents, the male and the female. And so it goes on to two grandparents, three great grandparents, and so on. And as you go back, tracing the genealogy of a male bee is the Fibonacci sequence. It goes 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, and so forth. Now, and then another one in the on the piano keyboard, returning to music. The keyboard consists of an octave of 13 notes, Fibonacci number. 8 of them are white, and 5 of them are black, another Fibonacci pair. And the black keys come in groups of 3 and 2, which are, again, your Fibonacci. And so I'm simply illustrating just a few quick examples there of how that sequence is embedded in nature. Now, what it ties together with, though, is the golden rectangle. Going back to your handout, the golden rectangle is a rectangle of such a ratio that the length is 1.618 times the width. So you take a rectangle, and I'll just freehand this, so it's not going to be that precise. But a rectangle drawn so that if you make a square in one end of it, take this distance, come and make a square here, why, you end up with another golden rectangle, this one. Then you come down, make another square, and you end up with the golden rectangle here. And you continue on and on and on. And on your paper, you can see what it would look like. The ratio of a long side to a short side of a golden rectangle is 1 to 1.618. Now, there's some reason why the Greeks knew this centuries ago. And so in buildings such as the Parthenon, and I have just a small picture here. The Parthenon, they have imposed, superimposed upon the Parthenon, you'll notice the golden rectangle, and then also in Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. And actually, as you look around, many times when there's something on the wall, there's something about that ratio that seems to be pleasing to the human eye. And so when you see artwork hanging on a wall, a picture, a mirror, the ratios are often very close to the golden rectangle. You usually don't walk in the living room and see a square picture or a square mirror. There's nothing wrong with square, but there's something pleasing. Even the paper we handle, why do we use oblong paper rather than square? I don't know. But now, so the interesting thing is that the ratio of the length to width of the golden rectangle is exactly the same ratio as the Fibonacci numbers. And so you find this Fibonacci sequence in sunflowers. Here's a photograph in space of a hurricane. You find it in various spirals. Here's a cactus. It's also found in the shape of the galaxy, of spiral galaxies in space all over the world. And so what we're simply pointing out here is that in the natural world around us, this is hidden. And you can imagine that God wondered one time, will anybody ever notice this? Now, God is honored when we give recognition to things like this. Also, the arm, the human arm, they say. I copied this out. I didn't check it out, but the ratio of your second digit to the first digit, if you check the ratio, you can check your own finger. So the ratio of the second digit to the first is 1.618, and then the next, and then to your hand, and then to your forearm and your arm. And so, of course, if your arm is longer, the proportion still stays the same. Moving on to a few other things in the natural world that are amazing that God has embedded there. One is the honeybee builds its hive in the most efficient way. It's more efficient. You get more storage space for the amount of building material needed with a hexagonal section than you would with either a square or, of course, if it were round, it would waste space. And it has to tessellate. If you used some other shapes like octagons, they wouldn't tessellate. And this book also points out that with the honeybee, not only does the honeybee use the hexagon to make its storage cylinders for its honey, but also the end of it, instead of being flat, is a very complicated apex. It says they have a series of regular hexagonal prisms, and the one end is, of course, is open, sealed with wax, and the other end is a pointed trihedral apex. And by using complicated geometry, you can prove why, or trigonometry, you can prove why that's the best. But of course, the honeybee knew that all along, and how they managed to build that without being told by the Creator how to do it is rather fascinating. And so, if you want a good read for yourself, why this points out that kind of thing. In addition to that, other wonder things about mathematics include such things as infinity. So we know that any time you have a circle and you can draw a diameter across it, and there's no limit to the number of diameters that you can draw. A diameter has no thickness, so you can draw 1,000, 100,000. You can imagine an infinite number of diameters, and an infinity has no limit, of course. However, every time you draw a diameter, you're also drawing, by definition, two radii. And so you could say that a circle has twice the number of diameters as it does radii, that it has radii. And yet, can infinity be larger than infinity? There are areas that our minds just reach a limit and we can't comprehend. Same thing would be true with a line and with a ray and a line. A ray starts at a certain point, has no end. A line goes both ways without any end. Is a line twice as long as a ray? They're both infinite. Another amazing thing is pi itself. The ratio of the circumference to the diameter is not exactly 22 over 7. It never terminates if you carry it out, and it never repeats. They've carried that out hundreds of thousands of places with computers, and it's an irrational, an irrational number. Any comments you'd like to make at this point? So what we're seeing here is that one aspect of mathematics and this spatial thinking is simply noticing at times the wonders that God has embedded in it there. Moving to a second section here, there's a very practical application to geometric thinking. You want to be sure when you teach children that they understand the concept. Kristen Light recently published this booklet that reviews all the geometric concepts that are embedded in the curriculum from grade 1 or 2 up through grade 6. And so it's a quick review of everything from area or volume of a sphere to cylinders to names of shapes, polygonal shapes, concepts like diameter, triangles, angles, using a protractor, and so on. And some children they know that when they measure something, you call it 4 inches or 3 centimeters. And then they know that sometimes when they calculate something, they're supposed to put an SQ in front of it. You know, this isn't just centimeters, this is square centimeters. And if you don't do that, it gets marked half wrong. So how do you remember when to, does it matter if the SQ is in this one? So sometimes you actually have to put a CU there. You know, sometimes it's cubic, sometimes it's square. And how do you know which is which? Well, some children actually think that way. You talk about thought processes, and they have no clue what the difference is between a square inch and a cubic inch. And so you want to be sure that when you study square, they know what we're talking about. If you have a building with tile on the floor, it's a very easy tool to use. That if you have 3 one way and 4 the other way, you can actually count them off and mark all 12 square feet there on the floor. And then, of course, if you're stacking blocks and they're cubic, we're actually counting the blocks. So be sure as you teach those dimensional calculations and measurements that they understand what they're talking about. Moving on to another aspect, looking on your outline to Part B here, logic statements. Geometry uses quite a bit of logic. It starts out with simple things. It'll make such statements as, if you have a line segment and you have a point away from that line segment, there's only one line that can be drawn parallel to this line that also goes through that point. And so it's a very obvious statement, simple statement, but yet this is a kind of statement that builds and builds and builds. And this goes far beyond just geometry. There are many everyday applications. There's a book written by a mathematician. I just realized in later years that he was a mathematician. And that's why some people reading this book despise it. Others kind of enjoy it. And his mathematician's name was Lewis Carroll. And he wrote a book called Alice in Wonderland. Has anybody ever read the book or read in the book? Well, in that book you read statements like this. Then you should say what you mean. I do, said Alice hastily. At least, I mean what I say, and that's the same thing, you know. Not the same thing a bit. Why, you might just as well say that I see what I eat is the same as I eat what I see. And you might just as well say that I like what I get is the same as I get what I like. You might just as well say that I breathe when I sleep is the same as I sleep when I breathe. It's the same with you, he said. Now, you start reading statements like that, you say, yeah, is I breathe when I sleep the same as I sleep when I breathe? There's a difference, because you're all breathing now, but you're not all sleeping. But now, this kind of logic has many applications, and it has applications in geometry, if you get into more high school geometry. But it also has applications in everyday life. Now, on your outline, I just have the 4 common examples of logic statements. Any geometry book, by the way, if you just want to get your hands on a typical text, I just brought a sample along. Harold Jacobs wrote one that's rather conversational. It does do proofs, but he has a lot of illustrations, and that's actually where I got this quote I just read from Alice in Wonderland out of that text. And he writes it in a way that's rather engaging, and for those of us whose heads hurt when we have to do geometry. Well, so a conditional statement is a statement that says if A is true, then B follows. If there's smoke, there's fire. Now, if that statement is in fact true, then you can build on that. If number one is true, then it's also true. The contrapositive turns them around and makes them both negative. It says, if there's no fire, there's no smoke. And if the conditional statement is true, then the contrapositive must also be true. It's logically true. Sound logic. Now, the converse simply switches B and A. If there's fire, there's smoke. Sometimes the converse is not true, because there can be other, it's possible to have a fire that is so well fed with oxygen that there's no particulate matter and so there's no smoke. But nevertheless, it's called a converse. And so on. Now, we don't have time to unpack these. I give these to you as resource material. You can go home and study it. But I'd like to move on and see how these things have application beyond just geometry. Applications. It shows up in the geometry in statements such as this. If an angle is less than 90 degrees, it's an acute angle. And that's how children learn some of these definitions. A right angle has 90 degrees. If it has 90 degrees, it's a right angle. If it doesn't have 90 degrees, it's not a right angle. And so forth. And then you notice that there are applications of this kind of thinking in Scripture. You'll find Paul writing something like this. If there be no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? And if Christ be not risen, then our preaching is vain and your faith is also vain. There are times that, especially in Romans, that there are some clearly logical statements made. Jesus said, ask and it shall be given you. Years ago, I read an article in which a person pointed out that if that's true, which it is, then if you say the statement backward, making them both negative, that's also true, and it would sound like this. If you are not receiving, you are not asking. Because if you ask, you will receive. So if you're not receiving, you're not asking. Now, there could be other reasons you're not receiving too, but it is true that you're not asking. It's interesting. Now, and as we grow up, even though your students might not ever take a course in formal geometry, they do need to learn to recognize faulty logic and accurate logic. Jesus said one time when the Sadducees and Pharisees were questioning him about the resurrection, where he came from, and so on, and he made a statement something like this. He says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And he seemed to say that you know the Old Testament scriptures and you know what this says. And if that is true, what it says, then there must be a resurrection of the dead. And if you put that in a logical statement, it would sound something like this. God can only be God to living people. If a person isn't in existence, God can't be a God to that person. And God told Moses at the burning bush that I am the God of Abraham. Not just I was, but I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore, those men must be alive. Therefore, there must be a resurrection. It's kind of a logical way of saying that based on what that says, there must be a resurrection. Children can have fun, can understand at a rather young age syllogisms. That's a kind of a logical, deductive reasoning. One of the most common syllogisms is this statement, all cows eat grass, Gerda is a cow, therefore Gerda eats grass. Now, syllogisms can be used improperly. For example, if you say all cows eat grass and Gerda eats grass, therefore Gerda is a cow. What's the problem with that logic? Somebody tell me. Correct. She might be a sheep, goat, some other animal that eats grass also. And there are people who actually think they're being very logical and think illogically. As I said this morning, there are other kinds of thinking we need to use besides logic, but in areas where logic applies, you better be sure that your logic is sound. And then syllogisms, Paul used one more or less in Romans 1. Where he reasons something like this. He says, men who have knowledge of God are accountable to him. The Gentiles have knowledge of God through his creation. Therefore, they are accountable to God. Now, at the bottom, you see a couple examples of improper use of syllogisms. The Pharisees reasoned that Jesus was a sinner and couldn't be the Son of God. Their first premise would have been, if a person is a sinner, he breaks the law of God. Jesus healed on the Sabbath, which is breaking the law. Therefore, he cannot be of God. That was their conclusion. And of course, there was a problem with that. And the next one, you can see the problem with that. Riches bring unhappiness. Same as unhappy. Therefore, same as rich. What's the problem with that logic? Why does that not sound? Right. There are numerous other causes also. And the last one I put in just for the fun of it, this isn't original with me. Breadcrumbs are better than nothing. Nothing is better than a good steak. Therefore, breadcrumbs are better than a good steak. Now, what's the problem with that logic? Actually, it follows the sound syllogism, but the problem is what? Somebody.
Probably
doesn't exist. Yeah, it's a definition problem. It's a definition of words problem, and that is nothing. What nothing means? Yeah, nothing means two different things in those sentences. All right. So, moving on, there is such a thing in logic and geometry as indirect proof. So, looking at that tic-tac-toe game, assuming that both players of tic-tac-toe are intelligent people, who went first? Who went first? Or whose turn is it now, whichever way? Somebody tell me. Pardon?
The
O went first. Okay. And how do we know that? That means it's X's turn now, right? If O went first.
Well, the O's turn now.
It's O's turn now?
Yes. I think X went first.
You think X went first? Oh, this is interesting. Let's decide. One way of doing this is that you can assume the one. You just pick whichever one and then reason through it and see how you come out. So, like it says here, let's assume that X went first. If X went first, then we have X, O, X, O, and...
It would be X's turn now.
Okay, it would be X's turn now. Mm-hmm. And so it says, if X went first, X, O, X, O, X would turn now. It says here that O went first. Why? How's that? Okay, yes. You don't want to give it away. You don't want to give the game away. And so you wouldn't allow O to be in a position where he can go next and make three in a row there. Well, let's move on to the rate to symmetry. Symmetry is another aspect of geometry in which you can see with the butterfly, bilateral symmetry, left and right in a leaf, left and right in a snowflake. There's numerous forms of symmetry. It's another visual thing. Then the next thing, tangrams are, who's ever used tangrams? Anybody? It's a Chinese, I think it comes from the Chinese. And yes, you see the square there divided into seven shapes. There are two, you can see how it's done. You take a square, and you could make a set of these with cardboard. You can cut them out of plywood. We have a set of these at school. They're in plastic bags like this. You could probably find these in school supply stores or homeschool supply catalogs or make them. So you take a square, and one half gets divided into two triangles. And then, as you can see, you have two other equal triangles, a square, a parallelogram like this, and another triangle. Now, what about it? Well, using those shapes, you can make probably an infinite number of designs. Every single letter of the alphabet, here's just an example of a few letters, using these basic shapes, you can configure every letter of the alphabet. You can make all manner of shapes of designs of people and things. And as you see there, with young children, you can start out by giving them something in real size. You can just lay them down and actually trace them all, and then they lay them on top. Then you give them papers without the lines on, and they have to figure out how to lay them on there. And then eventually you give them shapes that are smaller that they can't just lay on top. They have to match. It'll be congruent, but not the same size. And there's an excellent kind of thing if you need extra, well, yes, it can be extra. This is a thing to do sometimes. If you have a set of these for each child, you can, in math class sometimes, instead of doing math or for 10, 15 minutes, have them work on this, and they will really, at least some people will really enjoy this. They'll thrive on it. Or you have a table in the corner of the room where when they have a bit of extra time, they go and they practice. That actually develops a part of the brain. They tell us that this kind of spatial thinking actually does force the sides of the brain to work together. It develops a part of the brain that normal arithmetic doesn't really develop. That's this visual part. And some people, you're learning, students with learning disabilities, or that's not the best, learning differences, often are very, very good at this kind of thing. They're very, very visual. In fact, when it comes to seeing shapes or what the backside of something looks like, some people can look at something like this and they know exactly what it would look like from this side, from the bottom side, the top side, without turning it around. They can turn it around in their heads and see it from all sides. They can visualize it. Some people like myself, I have to stop and laboriously think about it. In fact, that's why some of those people, when they try to read and have trouble making out what the word says, you know what they do? They start turning the letters around to make sense out of them. So they turn the D upside down. And do you ever have children telling that the letters move on them? They move all over the place. And what they're doing is looking at that letter like this. And that's not helpful in a word. That's confusing. But in something like this, it is helpful. But then your verbal people who are good readers, you give them something like this, and they'll say, oh, I don't know what it looks like in the back side unless I can actually see the other side. We had a teacher some years ago who we were going to rearrange some things in the room, put a little corner in the room with a screen out, divider out, for a student who was distracted to sit back there and work sometimes. And she literally could not imagine what this was, would look like until we moved the screen and put it there, and then she stood in front of the room. Yeah, I think that'll work. She could not picture what it would look like. Now, for myself, I could at least picture that, but some people are visually challenged. Others are thrive on this kind of thing. And so tangrams are a very simple activity, but a very useful activity for children to work on, and young children can do that. There are numerous practical things you can have your children do in various ways. Years ago, Eratosthenes measured the circumference of the Earth, the circumference of the Earth, by simply, I think it was at Syene, which is close to what's today the Aswan High Dam. Here's the curvature of the Earth. There was a well, and on a certain day of the year, he knew, the sun shone directly into that perpendicular well, that vertical well, which told him that the angle of the sun over that point was 90 degrees. And then 500 miles north of there at Alexandria, the angle of the rays of the sun was about 7 or 7.5 degrees, whichever it was. And by 7.5 degrees. So you take 7.5 into 360 degrees, you come up with 48, I think it is, and then you take 48 times this 500 miles, and he calculated the circumference of the Earth to be 24,000 miles, and relatively close to the circumference they come up with today. And so there are such simple things as measuring, and your students might enjoy some projects like this, measuring the height of a tree by simply, or the height of a school building, going home and measuring the height of their own houses. If you have something like a tree and you simply go back from there a certain distance, you have a stake that's say 6 feet high, and if in fact, let me make this simple here for practical purposes. So if this ratio here, let's say this is 9 feet and this is 6 feet, this ratio of this to this is 6 to 9. Well, the ratio of this to this is also going to be 6 to 9, or 1 or 2 to 3. And so if you know what this distance here is, you measure this distance here and simply make a proportion, you can find out what the height is. There are other ways of doing that with angles. That kind of thing, you can easily find those illustrations in a reference book, even encyclopedia would give you various ways of measuring, for example, the distance across a lake, or the heights of things, and children can see practical uses for these things by going home and telling Dad, I can tell you how high that tree is without climbing the tree, although some children would rather climb the tree, I suppose. I brought along a box. Homeschoolers come across all kinds of resources, as you know. Anybody homeschool here? This is a box of foam shapes that my sister-in-law had. It's just this one set, and it involves either these, you could, the cubes, and then the double, kind of a double cube, and then an L, and the kind of the zigzag like that. Those four shapes, and then a few of these. That's all, just those basic shapes. And then there are three booklets, book one, book two, book three. And the object is to take, the object is to be able to draw, to make isometric drawings, to be able to look at this thing, build a shape, and then sketch it. And what the book does is starts out on a simple level where, with a dot diagram like this, you actually, first of all, build the shape, and then you'll sit at the table beside you, and then on here, you sketch what you see there. And it progresses from there until, as you get to the upper levels, it'll give you something like this, and this L, like this one. And if you tip this on its back, why then it should look like this. Well, if you get a more complicated shape like this one and lay it on its back, you should be able to also draw what that looks like. And if you're interested in looking at this, you can come up and look at this afterwards. These actually come out of Ontario somewhere. They are Canadian produced from Aurora, Ontario. She said her son, who's now 26, worked for a builder for some years after that. And he said, reading the blueprints and some of the design work that he had to do in working for the builder, he said he realizes that the practice he did homeschooling with these three little books really helped him to visualize those things. A relatively simple thing, with but requiring visual thinking. And so, in conclusion, what I want us to think about is the fact that in the world, in the physical world around us, the language of mathematics is really what God uses to, in a sense, construct the physical world. And there are many wonders visible there, embedded in that world. And also, as we work with this kind of spatial thinking, it does develop a different part of the mind. And it's a discipline. In school, it's good to stretch different parts of the mind. If you don't use something, you lose it. You all know that how sometimes if you do a different kind of work someday than you normally do, you get sore in places where you didn't know you had muscles. And those muscles don't get used regularly. Same thing is true with that that kind of thinking, that kind of spatial thinking. And then last but not least, there are some very practical applications. And I'll leave you with a little puzzle that, again, came from... Oh, it's on the end of your handout. I didn't get it right. You probably won't either. I got this out of this book. There's a bookworm. He ate a tunnel through a encyclopedia set. He started on page 1 of volume 1, read through the last number of page of volume 20, standing in order in a bookshelf. Each cover is 2/10 of a centimeter thick. Each volume is 4 centimeters thick. How long is the tunnel? Now, before you spend too much time doing your math, remember, it's a spatial problem. That's why everybody makes a mistake. Does anybody want to tell us how far he chewed? Or what mistake it is that just about everybody makes? You have books on the shelf, 20 books, and we all look at this and we say, well, he didn't chew through the first cover, and he didn't chew through the last cover, so it's 20 times 4 plus the covers, right? Is that what you're thinking? Well, what's the catch? How's that? No, it's the tunnel. It's the length of the tunnel. Well, the catch is that when you put a book on the shelf, where's page one? Where's page one of this book? Here or here? It's here. Okay. Page one is here. And over here, where's the last page? On the left side. Okay. So it's a spatial problem. He did not chew through the first and last line. All right. Thank you. You're dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.